Good morning, everybody. We're about to get started. Welcome back. For those who missed 2 weeks ago, we began a series about the issues of Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos, of saving a life on Shabbos. And today we're going to continue with that. You did not have to be here for the first year. The first one was basically an introduction. And let's just go quickly some of the highlights that we made. And that is the Gemara in Yuma talks about what is the source in which we know that one is allowed and one is obligated to be Mechal Shabbos, to violate Shabbos in order to save a life. And we went through all the different possibilities the Gemara has of how we know such a halacha, but what's clear is that we have an obligation, an absolute obligation to save a life and to desecrate Shabbos at all costs in order to make sure that we save a life as best as we possibly can. One of the issues that we mentioned, and that's what I want to pick up with today, is what the Shulchan Aruch says. The Shulchan Aruch writes, what if a person is a medical professional and they are Mechal Shabbos because they thought that it was a situation of Pikuach Nefesh. They thought it was a situation of a life-threatening illness and their medical expertise was necessary, and they go ahead and are Mechal Shabbos for the purpose of trying to save a life. As it turns out, once they get to the scene, they are not needed any longer, either because the person has already, God forbid, passed away, or because the person is already under control, has already been treated, and my medical knowledge, my medical expertise is not necessary at all to help the person out. Meanwhile, I was already Mechal Shabbos, so do we assume that I need to do tshuva? Do we assume that that is considered a chilul Shabbos, a desecration of Shabbos, or do you say no? My intention was to do something noble, my intention was to save a life and do what I'm supposed to do, and therefore we would not punish a person, we would not say that he or she are responsible for the act that they did, because at the time that they did it, they had the best of intentions in mind. So the Shulchan Aruch says that even if that would be the case, even if ultimately it turns out that you were not needed and all of your Chilul Shabbos was for naught, still says the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Shin Chav Ches and Aruch Chaim, we assume that you would be still in fulfillment of a mitzvah. Why? Because the Torah tells us you have to do everything to save a life. And if what you're doing right now, you think you are saving a life, even if ultimately it turns out that we don't need you, still says the Shulchan Aruch, that would be considered a mitzvah, and there is no reason to feel bad at all about what you have done on Shabbos, which leads to a very interesting discussion. When we talk in many other areas of halacha, and this is what I want to digress, it's not exactly relevant to this point, but I'm sorry, not exactly relevant to the whole Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos issue, but it's relevant to the point that we're discussing about various areas of halacha. Do we look at the result or do we look at your intention? And this is a very serious question. It's a question that comes up in many different areas. My father once gave me, back in the days when we had tapes in the world, so my father once gave me a tape of an incredible, incredible shiur. There's a very famous Talmud Chacham in Eretz Yisrael whose name is Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein. So he's a very interesting personality. He has all sorts of creative ideas in many of his svarim. He's a prolific writer. He's written probably over 40 or 50 svarim in the last 10 years. So it's pretty amazing what he's accomplished. But one of the things that I find interesting about what he does is that he has made a lot of the halachic process extremely relevant. You know, sometimes we learn a halacha and we say it's never going to come up. It never happens and it's not relevant. And this daf in the Gemara and this page in Shulchan Aruch, why are we learning this? And he has showed how every single page has somehow come up in a story, in a case that either he imagined or that he has gotten and has come through his house. So that, what I think, is a tremendous contribution on his part to the area of halachic study. So my father once gave me, many years ago, before he became such a prolific writer, Rabbi Zilberstein, my father got his hands on a tape of his. He happens to be an amazing speaker, and you can listen to him all day. But basically, he spoke in a shiur once in Yerushalayim about 5 different cases that he came up with. Some of them were true, some of them were not. But basically, he explained how all 5 of them can be explained with one basic principle in the end, and that's the way he answered all the questions equally. So that has a lot of relation to what we're talking about. I later found, after listening to this, I later found that 2 of them were written in one of his svarim. He has a 5-volume set of svarim that's called Shiurei Torah L'Rofim, where he put together a compilation of many different shiurim that he gave for doctors and medical professionals. And there, he quotes 2 of the stories. So he has a story there, which we'll read together, about a letter that was sent to him. And he has the original letter by the head of the Soroka Medical Center in Be'er Sheva. And the question goes as follows. Let's read together the first entry on the source sheet. Maisa b'yelet. So an unfortunate story, but it ends up being good. There was a child, she'ibed eshtei kaliyosef. There was a child who unfortunately had kidney failure. And it's unusual that a child has kidney failure, but that was the situation. V'haya zakuk l'trumas hakliya. And the child needed to have a kidney donation from somebody. So they were doing all sorts of testing to find out who would be a possible match for this child. It turns out that the mother was a perfect match for the child. She decided, the mother decided, because I'm a match, I'm going to give a kidney to my child in order that the child will have a chance at life. As we know, you have to go through a whole battery of tests in order to make sure that you really are healthy enough to go through with such a process. So she goes through this whole battery of testing, and they determine that the right kidney, matima lahashtala, that's the one that would be appropriate to take out and to give to the child. So they arrange everything, they test everything, they decide they're going to take the right kidney and put it to the child for the kidney donation. Ha'isha has mina, the woman is nervous about it, so she decides she's going to pay out a kit, minateach prati, she's going to go to some boutique, some fancy surgeon that's not a regular surgeon that everybody else goes to. She wants to make sure that everything's going to be just as it's supposed to be. She goes to one that is extremely experienced to make sure that she's going to get the best possible care. As it turns out, they come to the operating room and he makes a mistake. And by mistake, he takes out the left kidney instead of the right. Now, I called the doctor yesterday to find out, is this actually possible? Does it even happen? And this woman said, yes, it does happen, even though there's so much protocol in the operating room to make sure that you're doing the right thing. But look, we're all human beings, and once in a while, they do the wrong thing. And they're supposed to operate on this ankle, and they take out the other ankle. And they're supposed to fix this knee, and they fix the other one. So here we have a story like that. And this was a question that was sent by the director of the medical department in the hospital asking about the following. So it turns out they take out the wrong one. They take out the left one instead of the right one. However, la'achar bedikas kliyazu. So before they put it into the child to do the kidney transplant, they just do a quick test to make sure that everything's healthy. Nisbarer, it turns out, shahaya alav gidul. It turns out that there was a cancerous tumor on this left kidney. So imagine what would have happened. Imagine, had they taken out the mother's right kidney as they were supposed to, given it to the child, and later on found out that the mother's left kidney was infected, the mother would be left needing a transplant for herself. Now the doctor made a mistake. He took out the wrong one. It turns out they found the infectious kidney and took it out by mistake. But now the mother is left with a kidney. The child is going to have to find somebody else to donate a kidney. So it turned out being pretty okay. So the question is, V'ilu haya kores la'as hayimanis, imagine had he taken out the right one as planned, haya ha'gidol mispashet, the cancer would not have gone noticed right away, and it would have spread throughout the body. V'gam haysa nish'eres b'li kliya klal, and she would have been left without any kidneys, because they would have already removed the first one to give to the child, and removed the second one because of the cancer. Ki hayimanis haysa nechreses la'hashtala, v'hasmalas lo mitpakedet ekev ha'machala ha'mima'eret. Ninsa, it turns out, Sheyad Hashem kivna sarofe kidei lahatzel eschaya ha'em. It turns out God was obviously intervening and made the doctor make a mistake. Here she goes, pays out of pocket to get some fancy doctor to do the operation. She goes to a private practice, and it turns out the doctor makes a mistake. Obviously God got involved. Look at the last line, Nish'elet ha'sheila. So the question is, ha'em harofe chayev l'shalem l'isha. Yes, he ultimately saved her life, but he was involved in an awful malpractice. We're happy with the results, but in the end of the day, you are a highly irresponsible surgeon. And the question that was raised was, should the woman have to pay for the care that she got when in fact it was the wrong care? When in fact the doctor really made a horrible mistake? So the question that really what this boils down to is, do we look at the doctor's intent? And look, his intent was pretty bad. He intended to take out the left one because he thought that's what he was supposed to do, and he made a mistake. Or do we look at the outcome and we say, well, in the end of the day, the outcome is pretty positive and everybody's happy, so no reason to go and proceed with any sort of medical payment or anything that might be due for what actually happened. A fascinating question. He goes on, number bays. This is his style. A lot of times he puts together many different scenarios and shows how you can answer all of them. He goes on to say the second case. Chaval b'chavera, let's say you have some sort of accident in which you injure somebody else, but because of that, you save the person from death. Meaning what? The question goes as follows. Ruvain nahag b'mechonito b'choser zehirut. I am driving my car. I am being a reckless driver. I go straight through a red light. V'paga b'shimon. Somebody's crossing the street. I am not looking. I'm on my phone. And because of that, I bump into somebody and I injure them. They are rushed to the hospital. Shimon nizkak letipul rufui. Shimon now, who was hit by my car because of my reckless driving, now has to go to the hospital and be taken care of. Because he is now stuck in the hospital, he misses his flight, which ultimately goes down. So the question is, obviously, this doesn't happen every day, but, you know, once in a while it happens, but the question is, do I have to pay for the damages that were incurred, or do you say, well, the outcome was a very positive one? So these are the two questions he discusses in that book. The shear that I heard from him, he actually spread it out to five different scenarios, and one of them, you know, was very interesting. I don't know if this ever happened, but he claims that he got the following shaila. I don't believe it for a second, but he claims that he got the following question. He says there was a ganav in Bnei Brak. There was somebody who stole a car in Bnei Brak. So how do you steal a car? The car doors were locked, so he smashed the window or he broke the lock, whatever it might be, breaks into the car, starts driving down the block. He gets to a red light, looks in the rearview mirror, and sees there's a kid in the back seat of the car who's blue in the face. The parents forgot the kid in the car. Jumps out of the car by the intersection, starts waving his hands to try and get somebody to come and resuscitate the kid. A cop comes over, starts asking, what's going on here? He says, I don't know, just go and take care of the kid. They ask, well, whose kid is this? He says, I don't know. Well, how did you get your hands on the kid? Well, I stole the car. Well, we should arrest you. And they're getting into a whole discussion back and forth. It turns out he saved the life of the kid. And later on, the discussion was, should he have to pay for the damages that he caused to this car? Or should we assume that in the end of the day, the parents were so thankful that he ended up saving their child's life, even though something happened along the way, but he wants to know, should he have to pay because of what he did? And again, it gets down to the same question, do we look at the intent, or do we look at the results, at the outcome that will be the end of the story? This is a major, major question, and it really gets to what the Shulchan Aruch spoke about 2 weeks ago that we mentioned. When I go on a call on Shabbos, and I think I'm doing everything right, and the outcome, the result is that I'm not necessary, and it turns out all I did was Chilul Shabbos, and it was really for no reason. It turns out that it was for no reason. Am I responsible for such an activity or not? This is a very interesting question that really has far-reaching ramifications outside of the issue of Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos as well. What's fascinating is that the Gemara actually talks about this kind of case. Says the Gemara as follows, if you look at number Beis. The Gemara says in Menachos Daf Samach Dalet, we all know one of the Melachos on Shabbos is you're not allowed to trap an animal on Shabbos. A big question about whether or not trapping a human being on Shabbos is considered a Melacha as well. What does that mean? If I put my kid in a crib, that's not called trapping. But if I, let's say, incarcerate someone, I put them in jail on Shabbos, back in the days when we used to have our own judicial system, when we used to be able to do that to somebody, would we be allowed to do so on Shabbos or not? Is that a violation of Tzedah on Shabbos? Am I in violation of the malacha of trapping a human being or an animal on Shabbos? And maybe there should be exceptions to the rule of when we could do that. But the general case is that we're talking about trapping an animal. So the Gemara says, let's say you have the following. A person knows that you're not allowed to trap an animal on Shabbos. However, I have no interest in Shabbos, and I decide I'm going to go trap a fish anyway. I'm going to go throw out my fishing net. I'm going to catch some fish. I don't care about the fact that today is Shabbos. So the Gemara says as follows. I happen to go fishing on Shabbos, but I don't realize, this was before the days of a fishing rod. It was when they used to actually throw out a net to catch the fish. I don't realize that on the other side of the river, there's a huge commotion. Why? Because there was a baby that fell into the river. And everybody's trying to figure out, how are we going to get the kid out? I'm on the other side of the river. I have no idea what's going on. It turns out, I throw out my fishing net, and as I'm pulling it in, I pull the baby out of the water, not knowing that that was going to take place. That was not my intent at all. So the Gemara has the following story. De'idmar, lo shama shetava tinok bayam. I have no idea that there was a child that drowned in the river. I am not on that side. I don't hear all the commotion. I happen to be in my own backyard going fishing. Uparas mitzuda lahalos dagim. Here I am, Shabbos afternoon. I take a big fishing net. I throw it out into the river because I want to catch the fish. Vehala dagim. And all I come up with is the fish. Then obviously I'm going to be punished because I was mechal Shabbos. Chayiv. However, lahalos dagim, let's say my intention was to only catch the fish. But ultimately what I came up with my net was hala dagim vitinok. What if in the end of the day, I am so lucky and I come up with not only the fish that I was looking for, but also the child that was stuck in the river? Says the Gemara, this is a discussion. Rabba Amar Chayiv, Rabba Amar Pater. What are the two sides of the argument? Exactly our story. Says the Gemara. Rabba Amar Pater, Rabba says you are not going to be responsible for such an act. Why? Because Zil Basar Maisav. We go after your activity. And in the end of the day, the activity that you did was a life-saving activity. Even though you had no intention to save a life at all, your intention was to be Mechal Shabbos. Your intention was to catch those fish that you weren't allowed to catch. But still,
Zil basar maisa. We look ultimately at the act that was performed. And the act ultimately that was performed was a life-saving activity, and therefore you would not be punished for such a thing. But Rava Amar, absolutely not. You are going to be punished for that. Why? Zil basar machshavto. Because we don't only look at the outcome, at the result of what took place. We have to look at what led to the story. We have to look at what was your intention when you did that thing. Yes, ultimately you happened to luck out and you saved the child's life, but that was not your intention at all. So basically this really gets to the question of whenever we have a halachic scenario that has one intention but a different outcome, do we look at the outcome or do we look at the intention that the person had? Obviously, as we said, when it comes to Melacha on Shabbos for the purpose of a life-saving activity, we have every right to do whatever we can to be Mechal Shabbos, and we absolutely have an obligation to do so, even though in the end, it might turn out that the outcome is not what we were looking for. Even though in the end, the person might not be alive, or even though in the end, there might be other medical professionals that came already before me and did not need me to come. But if I was involved in such a thing, it's clear that we look at your intention as you were doing so, and we do not look at the outcome, which is something to think about. How would this play out in other areas of halacha? Now let's move on a little bit. The Gemara says, in Yuma daf pei dalet amud beis, which is number gimel, says the Gemara, ein osim dvar malalu, when we are involved in a life-saving activity on Shabbos, we do not do these things. Lo ayidei nachrim, we do not choose to call on a non-Jew to do it for us. So let's take this Gemara in two different pieces, two different parts. We'll discuss each one at a time. What does it mean, Ela Yidei Gedolei Yisrael? What does it mean you should be Mechal Shabbos for the purpose of saving a life via Gedolei Yisrael? What does that mean? This is a major discussion in the Rishonim. Generally, when we say Gedolei Yisrael, it means the leaders of the Jewish people. The Gadol be Yisrael. A man or a woman who is a leader of a Jewish people. And that's what the Rambam writes, Gedolei Yisrael v'chachameihem, which clearly indicates that the Gemara means to tell us that the people who should be involved on the forefront of life-saving activities are the leaders of the community. Gedolei Yisrael v'chachameihem, those who the community looks up to. Why? Because they will set the example for everybody else to learn from, that we don't take chances when we talk about lives on Shabbos. And we will do everything we can to be Mechal Shabbos in order to save that life and in order to make sure that nobody is in danger. That's perhaps what the Gemara means, Gedolei Yisrael. The Beis Yosef writes, no, that's not what the Gemara means at all. Gedolei Yisrael means adults who are obligated in keeping Shabbos as opposed to children who really don't understand about Chilul Shabbos at all. And what the Gemara means to say over here is, we should choose, we should prefer to have an adult be Mechal Shabbos to take care of the situation instead of singling out a child to take care of it. Why is that? Again, because we want that the adult should teach the children that this is something that we take very seriously. Saving a life on Shabbos is not something that we're going to compromise at all because of Shabbos. Shabbos is actually going to be compromised because of that. The Taz, later commentaries on Shulchan Aruch say, how can you say that this is referring to an adult as opposed to a child? What's the dikduk? What's the proper dikduk for such a thing? You wouldn't say Gedolei Yisrael. You would say... What? You wouldn't say Gedolei Yisrael. Gedolei Yisrael means the greats of the Jews. If you're talking about an adult Jewish male or female, you would say Gadol. You would say a Yisrael Gadol. Anashim Gedolim. You would say adult males or females. You wouldn't say Gedolei Yisrael. So therefore the Taz and others say that that is not what the Gemara means. But either way, what you see clearly from the Gemara is, don't take chances, don't try to get somebody who's a non-Jew, don't try to get somebody who's a child, go ahead and do it by yourself. You're an adult, you know what Shabbos is all about, go ahead and do it, because it's important that you teach the children, that you teach the other members of your community that Shabbos is something that we push aside in order to save a life. Now, what about the other part of the sentence? What about the part that the Gemara says not to get a non-Jew to do it on your behalf? So let's look. The Ran writes, the Ran is one of the foremost Rishonim, one of the foremost commentaries on the Gemara. So the Ran writes as follows. Let's read it together. Shahadvarim hatzrichim lechola sheyesh bo sakana b'Shabbos. When you have something which is necessary for the purpose of saving a life on Shabbos, ein osin oso klal ayidei nachar muktanim. We are not going to go out of our way to look for a non-Jew or a young child to do it for us. Va'afilu ba'akroi ba'alma. Even if it just so happens to be that the non-Jew is standing right here, and we can just as easily ask the non-Jew to do it or to ask the Jew to do it, still, says the Ran, we won't do so. Why not? So he says as follows, a little differently, Shema Yomer Habayim, says the Ran, because we're concerned that there's going to be something wrong that's going to come out of that next time around. Why? Because people who are standing around, who don't really, you know, every time you have a scene like this, there's a whole commotion, everyone's crowding around, nobody really understands exactly what's happening. So I happen to be the one in charge of the situation. I say, hey, there's a non-Jew right here, the babysitter's here anyway, why not have her drive to the hospital instead of having one of the Jewish members of the family drive to the hospital? Well, the problem is all the people on the periphery, all the people who are just observing and don't really quite understand what's going on, they're going to say, hey, next time we're going to have an issue of Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos. I remember last time Schechter said only the non-Jew is allowed to drive to the hospital. And there happens not to be a non-Jew here this time. So you know what? Let's wait another 5 minutes until we get the non-Jew from down the block. They don't remember the fact that the non-Jew happened to be standing there when the first emergency came up, and that's why I chose the non-Jew over the Jew. But because we're concerned, says the Ran, that maybe next time people aren't really going to process everything that took place this time, and next time a mistake might come about, and you never know, seconds really can count when we're talking about a medical condition, and therefore since we're concerned that maybe next time they're going to go out of their way and waste extra time to get a non-Jew to do it, and perhaps give up on somebody's life by doing so, therefore, says the Ran, we would never even take the chance of having a non-Jew do it, even if the non-Jew is standing right here and ready and able to do it in our place. That's the way the Ran explains it, which sounds very reasonable, and it sounds extremely logical, because we take life so seriously, we don't even want to take any chance like that maybe somebody would have a mistaken impression by something that we are doing at this emergency that we have right now. The problem is, if you look on number Hey, the Ramah, who is basically the guidebook of what all Ashkenazic Jews live their lives by, the Ramah vacillates about this issue, and he's not really sure. Says the Ramah, Yesh Omrim, some say, Dim Efshar Lasos Belo Dichui, that if you can do this life-saving activity without any delay, Uvelo Icher Ayidei Shinui, if you can do it in a way which is not exactly Malacha, Osa Ayidei Shinui, it's preferable to do it that way. Vim Efshar Lasos Ayidei Eino Yehudi, if you are able to do this life-saving activity by having a non-Jew perform it instead of you, Below Icher Klal, Osim Ayyudei Eini Yehudi Vichei Noagim. So the Ramah seems not to accept this Ran. And the Ramah says, well, if the non-Jew is standing right here anyway, if you have a babysitter in the house and she can just as easily drive to the hospital the same way you can, why not have her? Well, what about the consideration that maybe people are going to have a mistaken impression by the scene that they're watching, and next time they're going to make a mistake? How come the Ramah totally disregards that? So this is a very problematic Ramah, and the later commentaries say that we should not accept this Ramah, because it's a issue of a life and death situation. We shouldn't take chances. And again, like the Rishonim said, once you're going to take chances, maybe people are going to make a mistake next time and not going to rush to do the life-saving activity on their own. They're going to wait perhaps a couple of minutes until a non-Jew will come and maybe risk somebody's life in the process of doing so. So this is something we have to be very, very aware of, very careful about. Again, this does not mean that every time we have a situation of Chilul Shabbos, we should go ahead and do it on our own instead of having a non-Jew. That's not what it means. Let's say, for example, in Washington Heights, so they have an arrangement that when the Hatzalah members show up at the hospital and they bring in a patient, so obviously they drive on their own because that's Pikuach Nefesh, but what about the way back? So the way back is a whole discussion in the first place whether or not a Hatzalah member or a doctor is allowed to come back, but let's assume they are allowed to. That seems to be the accepted opinion in America, even though it's a very questionable one. But the accepted opinion is that you are allowed to come back. In Breuer's, in Washington Heights, the arrangement that they have is they pay a non-Jew that any time a Hatzalah ambulance comes to the hospital, a non-Jew will drive the members back after they have dropped the patient off. Why? Because again, that's not a pikuach nefesh. There's no reason for them to drive back on their own. So again, if you live in a community where there's only one Hatzalah ambulance, and by waiting an extra 5 minutes for the non-Jew to drive you back, you are risking perhaps a potential saving of a life because you're not going to be available to take care of. That's not what we're talking about. But there, where they have three ambulances and it's really not an issue at all, so they have an arrangement where they pay a non-Jew that any time the ambulance comes on Shabbos, the non-Jew should drive everybody back because that's not a pikuach nefesh situation. Again, we will try and limit the amount of Chilul Shabbos as much as possible if it is not at the expense of somebody's life. But if there is a possible expense to somebody's life or minutes of somebody's life, then we will not take chances and we will do everything we can to be Mechal Shabbos, like the Gemara says, Al Yidei Gedole Yisrael, by the adults or by the leaders of the community, and also not having a non-Jew get involved at all, to have the Jews do everything on their own. Rav Soloveitchik pointed out, my father writes in one of his Svarim, interesting idea, I'm not sure if it's correct, But it's interesting nonetheless. He pointed out that perhaps this is the source of why we have a Shalom Zachar on Friday night after a woman has a baby. So the question is, where does that come from? And it's very unclear where this started from and what it's all about. So Soloveitchik suggested that the idea perhaps is as follows. A woman had a baby. As we know, the first couple of days after a woman has a child is a very dangerous situation, and we are allowed to be Mechal Shabbos for her for certain things that she needs, because we assume that she is considered a chola sheyesh bo sakana. She is considered somebody who is in such a precarious medical condition that we have to do everything we can to save her life or to do things that will help her cure herself. So the Gemara says that even though she comes home and even though she's healthy, but we have to do anything that she needs on Shabbos within the first couple of days after her giving birth. So Rav Soloveitchik postulated, he suggested that maybe what used to happen in Europe was the following. The rabbi was concerned that he wanted to teach everybody that we really have to make sure that we take care of those who are not well. So anytime there was a woman who gave birth in the community, the rabbi would come to the house and visit the woman on Friday night and ask her, is there anything we can do to help your condition get a little bit more cured? So the rabbi used to come. Now the community sees the rabbi walking out on a Friday night to visit the woman. They feel, well, what's the rabbi doing? So everyone started going and following the rabbi, coming into the house. Someone mentioned last night at the shiur that, you know, we're thinking like men, because any woman would not appreciate any of this. But anyway, so apparently the practice was that the rabbi would go to ask if the woman needed anything. All the community, out of respect to the rabbi, would go and show up with him to find out if there's anything they could do for the woman to help her. And because of that, the woman felt, well, how can the whole community show up to my house without serving something? So that's how they started Shalom Zachar. Now, it's a nice suggestion, but then why is it only for a boy? Why is it not for a girl? It doesn't really make any sense. And I don't know, I have a hard time imagining that this is really what any woman would appreciate right after she has a baby. It's hard for me to imagine such a thing. But anyway, we think like men. Maybe we think a little bit differently. And I imagine a woman probably would have thought a little bit in a different way. But let's move on a little bit. We move on to a Gemara in Maseches Yuma, Daf Pei Gimel Amud Aleph. And this is an interesting Gemara. The Gemara here describes, what if you have somebody not on Shabbos? What if you have somebody who has a medical condition? And it's a strange kind of case. The Gemara describes a case of a doctor who tells the patient that the only way you're going to get better is if you eat a variety of food items that he puts in a list, but that variety of food items are all non-kosher. That's the only way the patient's going to get better. So again, we learned last week, v'chai bahem. We have an obligation to live by the Torah, not to die by the Torah, even though we know the laws of kashrus are very important, but if it's at the expense of our life, we are going to forfeit the laws of kashrus in order to save our own lives. That's clear. Now, the Gemara tells us, though, even though the doctor tells you you have to eat A, B, and C, which are all non-kosher items, there is a pecking order of how you should violate the laws of the Torah. So you'll say, well, either it's kosher or it's non-kosher. What's the difference? How can there be a pecking order in a non-kosher list of food items? Correct? Is that a valid question? Yes. Thank you. All the way from Lawrence. So the Gemara says, correct? So the Gemara says, Yuma daf pei gimel. Let's read it together. Misha achzo bulmus. Now we don't know exactly what this condition means in our medical terms, but you have somebody who has some sort of issue. Machilin osa afilu dvarm tameim. Says the Gemara, the doctor suggests the only way they're going to get better is if they eat this and this and this non-kosher item. So obviously we're going to go ahead and serve them those non-kosher items. Now, the Gemara there adds, Machilin oso hakal hakal tchila. We feed the person in a pecking order. We don't right away say, oh, take whatever non-kosher item you can get. There's a pecking order of which non-kosher items you can eat. Now, just to explain it a little bit more, let's say we know there are a lot of things in the Torah that you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to be Mechal Shabbos. You're also not allowed to talk Lashon Hara. Which one is worse? Being Mechal Shabbos is much worse. Why is it worse? Because the punishment for being Mechal Shabbos is much more severe than for talking Lashon Hara. Okay? We know you're not allowed to eat on Yom Kippur.
What are the punishments?
1 second. You're not allowed to eat on Yom Kippur, but you're also not allowed to eat non-kosher food. Which one is worse? Eating on Yom Kippur. Why? Because eating on Yom Kippur is punishable with kares. You're going to be excommunicated. God is going to cut you up. God's going to take away your life. That is much more severe than violating the prohibition of eating non-kosher food. Okay, so we know that there's a pecking order in other areas. Well, similarly, says the Gemara, there's also a pecking order when it comes to non-kosher food items. Now, what does that mean? Says the Gemara as follows. I forgot to put it on here. But let's say I have a choice between eating something which is tevel. Tevel means something which Trumas HaMaisvas has not been removed yet from this item, or Nevela. I have a choice between eating something which you didn't yet remove the Trumas HaMaisvas on the one hand, or I have a choice to eat something which wasn't shechted. So you have an animal which is a kosher animal, just it wasn't shechted properly. So which one should you choose? So the Gemara here says, Machilin oso nevela. We're going to feed you the non-kosher animal instead of feeding you the fruits that have not yet had the Trumas HaMaisvas removed. Why is that? Again, because you have to look at the punishments. So you have to be a big Talmud Chacham to figure out what the pecking order actually is. It's not so simple. But that's what the Gemara tells us. We try as best as we can to figure out what the pecking order is, and that is the way the person will go ahead and violate the Aveira. Even though you have an allowance to violate the Aveira, but we say you should try and limit it as much as you can. Okay, is that clear? Any questions? Good. So what's not clear is the Gemara doesn't really tell us what kind of patient we're talking about here. Are we talking about a patient who's in a life-threatening situation? Someone just had a heart attack. I mean, it doesn't really make sense because the cure for a heart attack is not eating non-kosher food. But somebody is in a real life-threatening illness. Really? They're going to have to sit there and have to make a calculation. Well, should I eat this food? Should I eat that food? I got to go call the rabbi. I have to figure out, well, which one's worse? Which one's better? Is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking about somebody who has a condition and medical research dictates that you have to eat the non-kosher food, but your condition is not life-threatening? So we would allow you to take this because we want you to get better, but you should really be making a calculation. This is a very big question about what exactly the Gemara is describing here. What kind of patient are we describing? Which is a very important question. And we have to keep this in mind when we talk about being Mechal Shabbos for a patient on Shabbos. Again, this idea of Hakal Hakal Tchila, we have to figure out what's the pecking order. What should be done and what should not be done. For example, there's a major discussion between Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, two of the greatest poskim of the last generation, two of the most recognized. Now, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman lived in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein lived in America, but they had a major disagreement about this very issue. You take, for example, a person is told by the doctor that you have to eat on Yom Kippur. Otherwise, it's going to be a threat to your life. Okay? So obviously, that's what you have to do. You shouldn't take chances. Do I have to go out of my way, pay extra money, to find myself near a hospital that they can hook me up to an IV the whole Yom Kippur in order that I shouldn't have to eat? So how far does a person have to go not to violate an Aveir in the Torah? Again, if the doctor says you must eat, otherwise your life is going to be in danger, okay, so I have to take something to eat on Yom Kippur. But do I really have to spend money to go to a hospital and to have myself hooked up for 12 hours on Yom Kippur to an IV in order that I shouldn't have to violate such as Shlomo Zalman? That is totally unreasonable. That's totally unreasonable. You don't have to do so. If the doctor told you that you're allowed to eat on Yom Kippur, what? What's the question? Correct. So you can bring the IV to the home. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman talks about that as well. Shlomo Zalman says, look, you don't have to stand on your head to have an IV brought to your house to buy this machine or to rent the machine and to have a doctor or nurse come over to the house and hook the person up for it and to sit there the whole Yom Kippur with the IV in you. That's not your obligation. That's way beyond what you're obligated to do. If the doctor said you're allowed to eat, you're allowed to eat. Forget about it. You don't have to worry about standing on your head to get around the system. That's the way Rabbi Shlomo Zalman suggests. Interesting. However, and again, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is not the first one who said this. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, who lived in Europe, who was killed in the Holocaust, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman writes the following. I forgot to put it on, but he says, the only time that we say that there's a pecking order and you should choose this over that and you should make sure to calculate everything carefully is only if both options are befanav mamish right now. If both options are available, easily, readily available in front of me right now, then we say, well, you may as well do this instead of doing that. Why violate something which is more severe? However, if one of the options is not readily available, and I'm going to have to order an IV machine and have a doctor or nurse come over to the house and pay somebody to help out with the whole procedure, that said, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, as well as Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, we would not assume that you have an obligation to go that far. On the other hand, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who's the posek of America, pretty much, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein very, very strongly disagreed, and he said, absolutely not. Let's say you have a doctor who knows that they have a rotation on Shabbos morning in the hospital. So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writes, well, that doctor, if they know in advance that they're going to have to be in the hospital on Shabbos, must take out a hotel room, even though it's going to cost them money, must sleep by the hospital for Shabbos, has no right to be Mechal Shabbos if they know in advance that they might have to do so. they must take out a room, they must go there for Shabbos, and that's what they have to do, and Rav Moshe Feinstein even writes, even if it means that you're not going to have Kiddush, you're not going to have Challah, you're not going to have meals, that's still your obligation, because Chilul Shabbos is more important than having Kiddush and Challah on Shabbos. That's where Moshe Feinstein writes, even if it means it's going to cost you money, even if it means being away from your family, even if it means all of that, that is your obligation because Shabbos is Shabbos and you don't have a right to be Mechal Shabbos if it was easily avoidable. Now this is a very difficult situation because it comes up all the time. Let's say, for example, the Magen Avraham writes in Shulchan Aruch and Shin Chav Ches that a person should do whatever they can to limit the amount of Chilul Shabbos possible. So the Magen Avraham says if a person knows, he quotes a Sefer Hasidim, person knows that their spouse, or you know, a woman knows that she is going to perhaps have a baby on Shabbos. So the Magen Avraham says from the Sefer Hasidim, you should do whatever you can to limit the amount of Chilul Shabbos. Again, it doesn't mean you shouldn't go to the hospital. Of course you should go to the hospital. But if there's a way to limit the amount of Chilul Shabbos, you should do so. So my father told us, before we had our first child, my father told us, well, in the eighth month, the probability of your wife having a baby is pretty slim, unless there's some sort of condition. But in the ninth month, or certainly in the second half of the ninth month, we assume, it's going to happen at some point. Of course, my wife was 2.5 weeks overdue, but it's going to happen at some point. So my father told us that, in his opinion, he felt the whole ninth month you should be spending. We were supposed to deliver in LIJ. He said you should be spending Shabbos in New Hyde Park. This way you won't have to be Mechal Shabbos. If your wife goes into labor on Shabbos, you'll be able to go right away. So again, I thought that was highly unreasonable to say that for 4 weeks in a row. I've never been pregnant, but I'm told it's highly uncomfortable, and certainly in the end, and to go spend Shabbos in somebody else's house when you might be going to labor might not be exactly what you want to do. You can tell me for yourselves, but I would imagine it's not exactly what everyone would prefer. So basically, what we did was, in the ninth month, you need to have an appointment once a week. So my wife made the appointments on Friday, and basically the doctor was able to say whether anything's happening, anything's moving or not. So the first couple of weeks of the ninth month, we did not go to the hospital. We did not go stay Shabbos near the hospital. But the last 2 weeks of the pregnancy, we did spend Shabbos in New Hyde Park, and that's the way we spent. And it happens to be, you know where we spent Shabbos? By a doctor who was living in New Hyde Park, because my father told him he had to live there because he's not allowed to be Mechal Shabbos to drive to the hospital. So that's actually where we stayed. It was an interesting situation. But that was the story with us. We were paid back because we actually had 2 out of our 3 kids on Shabbos. Thank God paid us back because we were so careful about Chilul Shabbos. He gave us a baby on Shabbos without being Mechal Shabbos. So that was a very interesting kind of outcome. You see? No good deed goes unpunished. But basically, that was the story with us. And this is a very fundamental question. How far out of your way do you have to go for a situation of Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos? Again, if a woman goes into labor and we know that it's dangerous, obviously you do everything you can. You rush to the hospital, you go right away, and you do what you can. However, let's say in our neighborhood, we have the Hatzalah taxis. Everyone aware of the Hatzalah taxis? I would hope you're aware of it. Hatzalah taxi is the Hatzalah's made a agreement with the taxi company here that you just call the taxi company on Shabbos, they will drive you to the hospital, and Hatzalah will pay them back. You're supposed to pay Hatzalah back after Shabbos, by the way. It's not free. You're supposed to pay Hatzalah back because Hatzalah is paying the taxi. So basically, why do we have such a service? It doesn't mean if somebody has a heart attack, oh, call the taxi instead of the Hatzalah. No. It means if a woman is in labor, and we don't assume that it's going to be, that the child is going to be coming out in the next half an hour, we assume once she's in labor, it's still going to take a little while. So why have the Hatzalah drive you to the hospital? It's not a life-threatening illness. Yes, she does have to get to the hospital, but he may as well take the taxi instead of having the Hatzalah. That's only in a case where there's no threat to somebody's life. But what about where there is a threat? We would not take any chances, as we said. You would drive on your own. You would have a Jew drive. You would have Gedolei Yisrael. There should be no corners that are cut in such a situation. So this is a very fundamental question. How far out of our way do we have to go in order to limit the amount of Chilul Shabbos? Should we assume, like Rav Moshe Feinstein, that we really have to even spend money, stay near the hospital, stay away from our families for Shabbos if we know that we have a rotation that we need to be at in the hospital on Shabbos? Or should we assume, like Rav Shlomo Zalman, that no, that's unreasonable, and when a Pikuach Nefesh comes up on Shabbos, a person can do whatever they want once Shabbos comes in? What is the basis? What is the underpinning of this disagreement? How do you understand what the issue is here? What are they disagreeing about as to how much a person has to go out of their way when it comes to a situation of Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos? And I believe what they're really... Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. So again, it has to be reasonable. You know, I've seen recently you have a podiatrist or a dentist comes to shul with a cell phone on Shabbos. I mean, when was the last time you ever had a case which is Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos for your kind of medical expertise? It's almost never. So you really You have to take all of that into account. Yeah.
Can we backtrack a second on what you said about the pecking order? You said that the punishment for not keeping Shabbos versus punishment for Lashon Hara, or whatever. First of all, I don't know what they are, so could you tell us? And also, I thought we never know what's going to tip the scale in one direction or not, and therefore every little thing that we do has that potential. So to me, that seems like it's more equitable and not one more severe than the other.
So that's a good question. How can you say about any given mitzvah or avera that this is greater than the other or this is less than the other? So that's a good question. What we do know is we are human beings, and we don't know exactly how God figures everything out, but what we do know is that there's a reason why certain things are punishable with death and certain things are not. We have an institution called Malkus. The Torah talks about certain averis that you violate where a person will get lashes. Other averis that you violate will be punishable with capital punishment. Obviously, the one with capital punishment is going to be much more severe than the one that is only going to get a punishment of lashes.
Right.
Not keeping Shabbos is punishable with kares. If a person violates Shabbos, you get kares. If there are witnesses, you get capital punishment. Kares is you get excommunicated. God won't let you into Olam Haba. That's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. Not a good thing. Eating in Yom Kippur is part of that list as well.
Mm-hmm. And Lashon Hara?
Which leads to an interesting question. How can there be more than one thing that is punishable with kares? Once you're cut off, you're cut off. Right? So once I eat on Yom Kippur, and that's punishable with kares, I may as well go be Mechal Shabbos
Maybe
the rest of my life?
Came on Shabbos that week.
Okay, but what about for the rest of my life? God doesn't zap me right away with a lightning bolt. So what's going to be the rest of my life? I don't have to keep Shabbos because I already am going to be punished with kares. So the Baal HaTanya writes, if I'm not mistaken, the Baal HaTanya writes, I just think it's an important thing to know of. The Baal HaTanya writes that what it means is there are 36 averas that are punishable with kares. So the Baal HaTanya says what it means is we are connected in 36 different cords, so to speak, with God. And each time you violate an iser kares, it means that cord is cut. So you have less of a connection. If, unfortunately, a person goes through life and cuts all 36 of those cords, well, I feel really bad for you. But, assuming that's not going to be the case, and you only violated one of them...
That's such an interesting number. How many cords? 36?
Okay, sounds good to me. Anyway, so let's get back to where we were. The disagreement here is, how much does a person have to go out of their way in order to save themselves from a potential Chilul Shabbos in a scenario of Pikuach Nefesh? Rav Moshe Feinstein says you got to go totally out of your way. Spend money. Stand on your head. Do something which is a heroic measure to make sure that Shabbos will not be violated if you know that there might be a potential Chilul Shabbos in your situation. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach totally disagrees. When my wife was in her ninth month, as I said, we spent Shabbos in New Hyde Park. And every Friday afternoon, Rav Asher Weiss, for those who were here last week, he spoke. So Rav Asher Weiss called me every Friday afternoon to ask me, where are you this Shabbos? So I told him that, you know, we're home, we might go to New Hyde Park, we'll see. And he was screaming at me on the phone. He said, what are you doing? This is so ridiculous. It's outlandish to assume that your wife has to spend Shabbos by the hospital. It doesn't make any sense. I said, look, that's what the Magen Avraham says. This is Rav Moshe Feinstein. He said, but it's just so unreasonable. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says not. The answer is, he lives in Israel. He goes by the Pesach of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who said heroic measures are not necessary. We live in America, we go by the Pesach of Rav Moshe Feinstein, who says that heroic measures are necessary. So this is basically what the issue boiled down to. And he ended up sending me a letter, which was a scathing attack on the way we acted during this period, and he was very upset about it. He ultimately printed that letter in one of his books. I asked him to please remove my name, which was removed. But you can look at it there, where he totally... disregards this opinion about having to go stay near the hospital in order to limit the amount of Chilul Shabbos because he feels that it's, like Rav Shlomo Zalman said, it's a heroic measure and there's no reason to do it. So what's the crux of the issue here? What are we basically disagreeing about? What should we assume is the issue between Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Moshe Feinstein? In order to understand this, I just want to give a little bit of a broader context in other areas of halacha of where we find a very similar thing, and I think that will really give us an understanding as to what the issue is here. Take, for example, we know that a Kohen Gadol is not allowed to be metame to a mace. He's not allowed to defile himself by dealing with a dead body. What happens if he passes a mace mitzvah? He's taking a walk one day in the park. It happens to be there's a homeless man who passed away on the side of the road. Nobody knows him. Nobody's dealing with him. He passes this dead body on the side of the road. Now, who's going to take care of him? The Kohen Gadol says, well, I can go back into the city and find somebody, but I'm the one who's here now. So the Gemara tells us that even though the Kohen Gadol is not allowed to participate in a funeral, when he passes a mace mitzvah, when he passes somebody who passed away without anyone to take care of them, immediately he must go and defile his Kedushas Kahuna, he must defile his Kohen Gadolship, shall we say, and deal with that dead body. Okay, that's what the Gemara tells us. Now, The question is, how far out of his way should he go not to defile his Kedusha? What should he do? So the Ramah talks about, what if he's taking a walk with somebody else? The other person is very queasy and is not interested in dealing with this. But if I pay him enough money, he'll figure out how to bury the dead body. So the Ramah discusses it. Should I have to even pay money to the person? That they should do it instead of me? How far do you go? This is a dispute amongst the Rishonim about how far Kohen Gadol has to go not to defile his kahuna when he finds a dead body on the side of the road. Does he even have to pay money to somebody to do it instead of him? Or do we say no? That's considered, like Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, that's a heroic measure. The Torah says, if you pass a meis mitzvah, you're the one who's able and available to do it, you should do it. You should defile your kahuna. What would we say in a case like that? It's a dispute in the Rishonim. What does that boil down to? What it boils down to is a discussion that is it hutra or is it dechuya? Which means, when the Torah says that a Kohen Gadol is allowed to defile his kahuna in order to bury the dead body, do we assume that in a scenario like that, it's as if he's not a Kohen? It's as if we forget about the fact that he's a Kohen. Do what you have to do and forget about the fact that you're a Kohen. It doesn't matter that you can get someone else, that you can hire somebody else. You right now are not a Kohen. This is what the Torah tells you to do. Go ahead and do it and don't ask questions. Is that the way we look at it? That it's hutra? It's as if you, your previous status is not here at all? Or do we assume that it's only dechuya? The Torah says, under these conditions, under these extenuating circumstances, when you have no other choice, well, you have no option, so this is what you have to do. But if there's a way around it, in the end of the day, you are still a Kohen. So you should do whatever you can not to have to violate the Avera. This is a fundamental question. Whenever the Torah allows me to violate an Avera, does the Torah mean to tell me that it's as if the Avera doesn't exist? Or is it that, yes, the Avera exists, just we allow you to bypass the Avera under these conditions? Is that clear? It's a little bit complicated, but I think the point is a very important one. Where you take, for example, another issue. I mean, it's Purim time, so we should talk about this example. We know if a person's life is at stake, and I have nothing to eat. Let's say we spoke a few weeks ago about somebody who's in the concentration camp has nothing to eat, and the only food that's being provided is non-kosher food. So obviously, you're allowed to eat the non-kosher food. That's clear. Now, there's a discussion, the Gemara says in Megillah Daf Yud Beis, Mipnei ma neschayvu Yisrael shaba'osu hadar kliya. Why is it that in the times of Ahasuerus, in the times of Mordechai and Esther, Haman, why is it that the Jewish people deserve to die? Lahashman laharugul avid. What do we do wrong? What do we do wrong? Why do we deserve the punishment that we got? The decree, the whole story, what was that all about? Says the Gemara, Mipnei shenehnu misudas Ahasuerus. Because they had pleasure from the meal that Ahasuerus served them. Now I ask you, says the Chasam Sofer, Ahasuerus invites you, sends you a personal invitation with a chariot to come and pick you up, to come to his palace and have a good time by him. You're going to say, oh, I'm sorry, you're not serving kosher food, I can't come. Maybe in a democracy we can do such a thing, and they can make an arrangement. But this is Ahasuerus we're talking about. Aren't you afraid for your life? You can't not eat. What do you mean? The king invites you to a dinner, you're not going to eat? Your life is on the line. So ask the Chasam Sofer, how can that be the reason why they deserve to die? What did they do wrong? Their lives were at stake. Ahasuerus sends every Jewish person a personal invitation. You better come to my party and eat something there. What can we do? Our lives are on the line. So he's serving non-kosher food. Too bad. What are we going to do? It's like the concentration camps. Same thing. Answers the Chasam Sofer that the Gemara says, Mipnei shenehenu misudas Ahasuerus. What attitude do we have when we're sitting at that party? Of course you're allowed to eat. But when the Torah says that because of pikuach nefesh, you're allowed to eat non-kosher food, how do we look at that violation? How do we look at that of bypassing the system? Does the Torah say, well, it's as if the food is kosher, so go enjoy it? Or does the Torah say, no, you're allowed to go ahead and do it, but don't forget, you're eating non-kosher food. Don't forget, you're eating non-kosher food. You better not enjoy this. You better limit the amount of portions that you're going to take. So that's the question, and that's the basic question that comes up in many of these kind of scenarios. Should we assume that it's hutra when the Torah tells me you're allowed to go eat by Ahasuerus' party? Do we assume it's as if the food is now magically kosher because, hey, the Torah says you're allowed to look out for your life, so therefore you can eat whatever you have to eat? Or do we assume, no, it's only the chuya, the food is not kosher, and you better remember that the food is not kosher. And yes, under extenuating circumstances, you're allowed to participate, but you should limit as much as you can the amount of non-kosher food that you're going to eat. Question? So that's the question that comes up in many different areas. Yeah. Yeah.
So apparently, Rabbah was saying that we measure it by the result, not the intent.
Correct.
So apply it over here, you're saying we measure by the intent.
I mean, that's the fundamental question. How do we look whenever? That's basically what today's shir is. How do we measure whenever the Torah says you're allowed to do something?
So then the measuring result versus intent depends on the situation.
Exactly.
There isn't a single answer.
Exactly. That's why all of those cases that we mentioned before, you have the case of the car accident, you have the case of the doctor who made the wrong surgery, and all these kinds of things, I'm not sure that they can all be answered so simply. They don't all boil down to the same answer. But it's something I just wanted everyone to consider it. That's why I put it out there. So this is a major discussion. Whenever we have a scenario like this, should we assume that it's hutra or dechuya? And I believe that is the crux of the issue here as well. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Reb Moshe Feinstein are arguing, should we assume that when we say that a person is allowed to be mechalel Shabbos in order to save a life, should we assume that it's as if Shabbos does not exist today? And therefore do whatever you want. Doesn't matter how you violate, doesn't matter how much violation you do, just do whatever you can, and there's no reason to spend money to have a non-Jew, there's no reason to do anything that's heroic. Just go do whatever you can, because today is not Shabbos. Or do we assume, no, today is Shabbos. It happens to be on Shabbos. If the situation calls for this, you're allowed to violate Shabbos as much as necessary, but you should limit it. This is the question that I think they're dealing with. How do we look at it? How do we understand this halacha of pikuach nefesh on Shabbos, that pikuach nefesh overrides Shabbos? How do we understand that? Does it mean that Shabbos absolutely does not exist when we have a situation of pikuach nefesh? Or do we assume that Shabbos is here and we have to limit as much as possible how much we're going to violate it? That's basically...
Should we make over with Shabbos, or should we machmer with pikuach nefesh?
Right, that's the question. Should we be makel with Shabbos, or should we be machmer on pikuach nefesh? That's part of the issue, exactly. I think this relates to yet another issue, but this will close. The Magid Mishnah, one of the Rishonim, writes as well, when you have a chole sheyesh bo sakana on Shabbos, you have somebody who has a life-threatening illness, you rush them to the hospital, you take care of them, you do everything you can, says the Magid Mishnah, and this is quoted in Shulchan Aruch also, osen lo kol tzarachav, you do whatever it is that they need, whatever it is that they ask for. The way the Shulchan Aruch quotes it is, anything that you would do for them b'chol, anything that you would do for them on a regular day of the week, you do for them on Shabbos as well. So let's say, think about the following case. Let's say, you have a patient in the hospital, life-threatening illness, very dangerous, you're taking care of them, you happen to be one of the medical professionals. Person says to you, can you please turn on the TV? Well, that's not really directly affecting their medical condition, but at the same time, I would do it for them during the week. It does help calm them down. It does help distract the patient. So again, it has to be reasonable. You can't be, you know, if the patient comes along and says, well, I want you to drive around 100 times around the block and come back, well, that really is just an unreasonable expectation. But if the patient is asking something that could be something which would relate to their medical condition, even though generally we wouldn't say, well, there's medical research that really turning on the TV helps. But if they ask me, can you light a cigarette for me? Probably wouldn't help their medical condition. But if they ask me, can you turn on the TV? Can you do this? Can you do that? And it's something that perhaps would help their situation, and it's something that during the week we would do to help them out. It's something we would never hesitate to do during the week. Then says the Magid Mishnah, you're allowed to do that on Shabbos. And that's also a major point of contention. Should we assume that way, or should we not? And what's the issue there? It's the very same issue. When we're dealing with a patient who's in a situation of a life-threatening illness, do we assume that Shabbos is simply not here? Shabbos doesn't exist. And if Shabbos doesn't exist, you know what? Go turn on the TV, go switch the bed, go, move all the different things, play with the machines, do whatever it is that the patient asks you to do. Or should we assume, yes, Shabbos is here. You better remember that today is Shabbos. And again, if the patient asks you to turn on the TV, you should say, by the way, today is Shabbos. Let's think about this. Do you really want me to turn on the TV? Do you really want me to be Mechal Shabbos? You have to think about that. And this is the same issue that Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Reb Moshe Feinstein are arguing about, is the issue that really dates back way earlier to, should we be allowed to do any activity for the chola's well-being, even if it's something which doesn't directly relate to the medical condition, for example, turning on the TV, or should you assume that no, one should shy away from doing so on Shabbos, because in the end of the day, today is Shabbos, and Shabbos should not be violated in such a way. Okay, Mirtz Hashem, next week we will continue with a little bit more of the practical applications of